Yesterday we concluded our consideration of Christianity in the ancient world. It's very hard to say just when the ancient world ends and the Dark Ages begin, because it was different in different places. In Romania, you might say it was 378, because that was when the Goths broke through into the empire and at the Battle of Adrianople, and when they succeeded in taking over quite a section of it. But the Theodosius managed to hold things in line for nearly another 20 years, and then even while the marauding tribes were going back and forth through the empire, life continued to an amazing extent. And so we had quite a large number of very important events that we considered between 380 and 460 A.D. But by 460, the civilization of the ancient world had been so generally disrupted that I believe you should really start the Dark Ages at pretty close to 460. Of course, there were sections in which the old civilization continued a bit longer, and there were sections in which it had practically disappeared quite a little while before that time, something as much as 50 years before. But since we're going by centuries more or less, I simply glanced at the rest of the history up to 500. Now I want to not take so much detail during the next 1,000 years as we've taken on that 400. It is far less important for our understanding of the world today to know what happened during the next 1,000 years than to know what happened during those 400. During those 400, the world, even though it lacked a great many of our technical advances, was far more like our present world than the world was during the next 1,000 years. And there are so many things that are so similar to situations in our day in those 400 years that it is a period of tremendous importance for our understanding of the world in which we live. Similarly, the period from 500 on is of even more importance to the world in which we live, of course, because it is directly that which led into our present world. And that's what we deal with next fall. I wish we could make the division at about 1550 and could include those 50 years this year, simply because I get terribly jammed trying to cover from 1500 up to 1969 in 1 year. But it is the natural division. It's about 1500. And we'll have to stick to it, though we get terribly jammed in the latter part of next year. But of the period from about 400 until 1500, a period of over 1,000 years, the last 300 or 400, naturally, is of much more interest to us than the first 600. The first 600 was a period when, you might say, Europe was like a nation which had been thoroughly bombed and was in a state of ruin, with a few families living in cellars here and there and trying to survive, and many people picking out bits of the rubbish and trying to get along and gradually getting out of it. And it took about 600 years before you can think of things as having been fairly well reestablished, even though on a level of civilization and culture far inferior to that which characterized the world in 400 A.D. And so instead of going by centuries, as we've been doing, I would like to take this whole period of 600 years, more than 1.5 times as long as the whole period from the death of Christ to the Council of Chalcedon. I'd like to take that whole period and look at it as a unit and try to get an idea of the developments and movements in it. And we'll do this fairly hastily. I find myself, as I review the material, it is amazing how, even in my own mind, these years from 450 to 1450 sort of kaleidoscope. And you think of certain developments, and they seem to be way back in the Dark Ages, and then you look up a precise date and find that they happened when this thousand-year period was two-thirds over. It's amazing how much of what we think of as being in the Dark Ages was actually after 1,000, or at least after 900 A.D. So that this period of about 600 years, a very, very long period, a period in which, well, to think of just how many people lived and died, and how little of would be passed on from family to son During that time, I just ask any one of you how much you know about your great-great-great-grandfather. And there's probably nobody here who could tell me anything about his great-great-great-grandfather. And if I were to say your mother's 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 mother, why, you wouldn't even know her name, the chances are. It's a rare person who would. But if you were to tell me something about all of your ancestors who were living even as much as 150 years ago, when there probably were 32 people living whose blood runs in your veins, at least 16 were, why, you would just, if you could name more than two or three of them, it would be strange. And that's the change that can take place in 150 years, and here 600 years. It is enough time for tremendous changes to take place in the world. And they did. But these changes were, first, from a great cataclysm of which we have comparatively little evidence, because when people are struggling for survival, they're not sitting down writing history. They're trying to get a few scraps together to live on and trying to protect themselves from the next bunch that may come through and may steal the women of the family and stab the men and march on. And we have comparatively little evidence of events during the catastrophe, but within a period of less than a century, the catastrophe is over, and then gradually we get a little light as things gradually begin to clear up. And it is really 600 years before we see much of a clear picture of events again. But we have a number of isolated events during these 600 years, and we want to get something of an idea of the situation as prelude to the next 400 years, of which we know a great deal, and there are many events of tremendous interest, and some of them have great importance in relation to the world today. But we will rather summarize these 600 years and take maybe two or three weeks on it, and then spend the rest of our time on the last 400. So I'm going to call 8 the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages, and I'm going to roughly call it 600 years of semi-civilization. The Dark Ages. A long period, as you see, and a period of which we know a good deal about isolated incidents here and there, but very little in detail beyond that. Of course, you take maybe 50 isolated situations, you put them together, we could spend a year looking at this period of 600 years. But for our purpose here, we just want to look at the outstanding developments and to try to see a little of their relationship to each other. And so under that, I'm going to take capital A, the political and cultural situation. Capital A, the political and cultural situation. And under that, one, the great cultural decline. The great cultural decline. I've already referred to the tremendous loss of property. In 400 A.D., I imagine there were... Yes, sir? Cultural is... by that, I refer to the manner of life of people, and particularly which relates to their general thinking process, their general habits and activities in general. It's a very, very broad term. It doesn't just mean who rules. Who rules can affect it, but it's a comparatively small part. But it's a very broad term, which describes the manner of life in total, not with the great stress on the economic, but considering that as simply one phase. Good question, not an easy one to answer, but it's a term that's used a great deal, and it's good to stop and to explain exactly what we do mean by it. I don't think I ever heard it defined before. I don't think I ever tried to define it, but I think that covers it pretty well, what I said. When you say cultural, though, we're not thinking so much of the fact, though it enters into it, that there was no longer a ruler somewhere in Italy whose orders went out all through most of Europe, and those orders were pretty much obeyed, and who had his representatives maintaining law and order everywhere. This really came to an end before the 5th century had gone along very far, and continued even in name only until 476. We're not thinking primarily of that. We're not thinking primarily of the fact that of the city of Rome, which in 400 A.D. probably had as many as, let's say 50 families, each of which possessed the equivalent of $500,000, thus had tremendous power, tremendous influence, tremendous opportunity for education, that practically all that material which might have maintained those families for centuries was plundered, carried off, used up and dissipated and destroyed, and much of it simply left in ashes. The city of Rome, which perhaps had 1 million people during part of the ancient world, during the Dark Ages, sunk to where it had less than 50,000. And the same is true all over Europe. We're not referring principally to that when we speak of the great cultural decline. We're not referring to the fact that the ships which before that time were sailing between the great harvest fields of North Africa and of Egypt and carrying great amounts of food to Europe, and bodies of people who were taking that food and distributing it through Europe, selling it here and there and collecting the products of each country and taking it to another, all this practically came to an end. Maybe there was a fifth, maybe a tenth as much activity of that type carried on during the 6th century as there was during the 4th. We're not referring primarily to that when I speak of the cultural situation. I am thinking more of the fact that during the 4th century, most of the citizens of the Roman Empire could read and write. Most of them had an active concern with the government of their local town or of their province. Maybe not a great concern, but probably as much as most people in our country have today. They were interested in what happened. They were interested in the news. They were trying to carry on with it. They were sending some of their family off to centers of learning, perhaps, those who showed particular aptitude. All this came to an end. People, as a rule, were, that is, the old populace of the Roman Empire, was unable to travel, mostly confined pretty much to their own local area where they were struggling to get a living, to get along in any way possible, and they had no time to think of teaching their children to read and write. And literacy decreased till there were not 1/50th as many people in Europe who were able to read and write by 700 as there had been in 400 A.D. The whole cultural situation, the situation of those activities which give meaning to life, which are not immediately connected with keeping alive and with getting enough to eat, that all degenerated to the point where if it had not been for one particular religious factor which preserved a certain amount, a small amount of the literature of the previous time, we might not even know there had been a great civilization in ancient days. So this great cultural decline occurred and continued through a great part of this period, though with a certain amount of gradual improvement here and there. Then number two is lack of any strong center to produce peace and order. I see that in explaining number one, I really covered that pretty well. Lack of any strong center to produce peace and order. And I don't merely mean that there was no emperor in Rome or Ravenna or Milan with power over the whole of Western Europe. I mean there was no one in one of those places to maintain law and order in Italy. There was no one in any great city in France to maintain law and order, or in any great city in England capable of doing so. That people had little chance of knowing what happened more than a few miles from their home, and then, of course, the great migrations of groups were going through, plundering and marauding and gradually settling down here and there, but some of their members still continuing pretty much of a tyrannizing activity over the rest of the world for all through this period. And so this naturally leads to number three, the development of the feudal system. And that is a characteristic term for the Middle Ages, for the political situation of the Middle Ages, is the feudal system. F-E-U-D-A-L, the feudal system. It's strange how our word feud is utterly different from this feudal system. The two would seem to be the same word. I don't know how they're related, actually. But it's nothing like what our present word feud would suggest. The feudal system, was a system in which the people in each little area had to look to people in the immediate neighborhood to find protection. And after a family had been having a fairly good living with growing their own crops and producing enough that they could sell to others and have enough left over to have what for those days might be a fairly good living. After a family like this had seen a group of marauders come through and destroy in 2 days what they'd built up in 50 years and leave them in a pretty bad situation, after they got rebuilt enough that they could survive if another group didn't come soon, their next thought would be, how can we protect ourselves from the next onslaught that's apt to come? And so they were apt to look around the neighborhood and find that somewhere within 15 miles there was a family or a group, or even maybe a group of the invaders who had settled down there, who had not been injured by this group that came through. They had managed to fight them off and been undisturbed. And they said, let's go and ask them if they won't help us next time and protect us from the next group. And so pretty soon you had little centers where an individual would have all the people in his immediate neighborhood coming to him and saying, will you protect us? And he would say, yes, I will protect you. You recognize me as your overlord. You recognize me as having control over you. You give me a certain amount of produce each year. As time went on, they came to make it pretty definite terms. How much produce was to be given? And also, in case of need, you come and fight on the side of my men against attackers and be under my order. And so you had these little groups all over Europe, maybe 1,000 such groups, maybe 10,000, I don't know, where there'd be an individual center of power with people gathered under him. And then when one of these was destroyed by a marauding group or by a large tribe that came through, when a number of them were and one survived, the others would come to him and say, how did you survive? Will you protect us? And so the individuals in these different groups, who had each of them an area maybe 5 to 20 miles square that was under his general supervision, the leaders of these groups over an area maybe 100 miles in circumference would get together, and they would come to one leader there. And so the feudal system was a system in which there's no central power that has any real control, but in which you have individuals in an area promising subjection and loyalty to somebody in the area who will protect them. And then these men, who are a little higher in the scale, from a somewhat larger area, promising allegiance to another one, over maybe 20 or 30 of them, and agreeing to give him a certain number of soldiers on demand and to supply a certain amount of produce to him, and he agrees to take charge and protect them, and then they together go under certain other ones. And thus eventually you have a large area which can nominally be called a kingdom or even an empire or whatever title is given. The leader of it has power actually only under the men right under him, and they are quite independent of him in their areas, provided that they provide him with the soldiers they've agreed to and with the produce they've agreed to. And if one of them goes back on his obligation, he can easily summon the others to put this one under subjection. But so long as they turn in what they're required to, he has no power of interfering with them beyond that. And thus the loyalty of each one in the group is only to his immediate superior. And if that immediate superior revolts against the one above him, he's got the folks underneath obligated to him rather than to the immediate superior. And so what we think of today as nations were simply not existent at that time. There was the Roman Empire, which embodied all the area from England, from what we call England, all the area over clear across the southern two-thirds of Europe, or the southern half of Europe. This had been one unit before, and now it's broken up into thousands of little units, and these tied together with this feudal system, and no sharp line anywhere in the whole area. but not much interrelation between large areas either, because it's just too dangerous to travel and too difficult to get the means to travel. So you have this feudal system which gradually develops as just about the only means possible of giving protection and ability of survival to the people in the area. But along with this, all through that 600 years, there is a theory, an idea, which continued. Whether it continued in the minds of everyone or whether it was preserved in the monasteries, I don't know. But by the end of the period, it comes to be quite a force, a certain theory. So we call number four the theoretical continuance of the idea of the Roman Empire. The theoretical continuance of the idea of the Roman Empire. In 475, when the Germanic chieftain Odoacer had taken Romulus Augustus, the young man who was nominally Roman emperor, and destroyed his power, and he said, what's the use of appointing another puppet? He sent word instead to Constantinople and said, you are the emperor of the Roman Empire. I have put to an end any one claiming such a title in the West here. Please recognize me as the patrician or some other title as your representative back here. And the man in Constantinople had nothing either to gain or lose by doing it. I don't know whether he actually did. But theoretically, the Eastern Emperor was the emperor of the whole Roman Empire, but he had absolutely no power in the whole of Europe, at least west of Greece. And so that the Roman Empire would have just disappeared, but this idea remains, that there is a Roman Empire. And this contributed, incidentally, very greatly to the development of the papacy. It contributed in certain specific ways we'll look at later. But in general, it contributed. Because if there is theoretically one empire, it's natural to think there's also one church. And even though we don't know of any real head of empire now, there is a man from Rome, the great center of the empire. There is a man there who claims to be head of the church. And when the local representatives of the church are doing what is wrong, it's a rather natural idea to send a message to Rome, if you can find somebody who's going there, to the great head of the church and ask him to give you some relief. And so we find people doing this off and on through this period. And as I say, whether the monasteries kept this idea alive then, or whether it was kept alive by political leaders, I don't know. But it did remain and was a force in history up till, say, 100 years ago. And it became a great force from about 1100 on. Number five, the beginnings of nationalism. The idea of nationalism is a very potent idea today, but it was non-existent at the beginning of the Dark Ages. The Roman Empire was one area. It was not a nation, it was an empire. And in this empire, the feudal system gradually developed. All through this empire, the people spoke mainly one language, the Latin language. And of course, gradually, it's changed slightly in all the different areas, just as our English in this country has changed, so that a person from Maine and a person from Massachusetts and one from New York speak so utterly differently that you can recognize anybody whose family's lived in either of these areas for three or four generations. You can immediately recognize which of the three they come from. And today, when everybody's moving, this is being rapidly broken up. But as much as 50 years ago, I knew people who could take... I know a woman came to Princeton Seminary when I was there, and she said, any one of you, she said, give me this sentence. She said the sentence. You say this sentence, and I'll tell you what state you come from. And there was a boy there who was thought he'll fool him. He was brought up in China. And so he gave the sentence. And she said, I never heard anybody speak like you do before, she said. But he says, I can't tell whether you come from New Jersey or from Maryland, she said. And she said, that's a queer combination. I can't understand it. Well, he says, he was brought up in China. He came to this country when he was 20. He says, you know, it's strange. He says, my father came from New Jersey and my mother from Maryland. And so, gradually, the one language changes when people are together in an area without having a great deal of communication with people in another area. That's now disappeared with television and radio and with a great deal of travel. But still, a certain amount of it remains in this country. In England, there's still a tremendous amount of it. In Germany, there's many dialects today. And in Italy, still more. And in some of these areas, the people with one dialect just can't understand the other at all. But the Latin language, the one language understood all of the Roman Empire. That language continued to be the language of culture. And people wrote their letters in Latin language. They carried on their lawsuits, if they had any, in Latin language. If they sent a letter to the Pope, they sent it in Latin, though it was often what you might call pig Latin. But he could perhaps figure out what they were saying. But today, in the area that was the old Roman Empire, all the way all the way from Portugal on the one side, clear to Romania on the other, there are a dozen languages, all of which have developed out of Latin. And it's developed in different ways, but you can see the relation between all of them. And yet, in this, and also the people who conquered these areas were various Germanic tribes who, while they had their own dialect, could all understand one another. They spoke an early form of German. They could all understand one another, and they conquered the area of the Roman Empire, and also the area that we today call Germany came to be held by them, and also England. And they, as they conquered it, and as they settled down in different areas, their language and the local language can in some way, to some extent, to get fused together, and gradually languages develop. But even when in the 14th century, when a man from Venice was put in a prison in a different Italian city, this man named Marco Polo from Venice was taken prisoner in this other city, and a man from Genoa, which was not over 150 miles from Venice, was also a prisoner there, and they were put in the same cell, but they couldn't understand a word either of them that the other said. Shows how much difference had come in dialect. And since they couldn't understand what the other said, but they both knew French, they talked in French. And the other man asked Marco Polo to tell him about some of his interesting experiences in life, and he told about his trip to China. And the other man said, "My, that's interesting. Will you let me write it down?" And so he wrote it all down. And so Marco Polo's account, one perhaps of quite a few travelers who went to China in that period, which is after the period we're now looking at, not a great deal after, his account was written down in French because the two Italians couldn't even understand each other, which shows how dialects developed, and there was no such thing as a language in the modern sense. There was just a slight difference from one area to the other within the area of the Roman Empire. But gradually, during that period, there came just the beginning of certain areas considering themselves as a large area that was a nation by itself. Its population was composed of the old Roman inhabitants, the earlier people the Romans had conquered, and the particular Germanic peoples who had eventually decided to settle down there. It was a mixture of these three in all these places. And it's purely accidental. That is to say, there's no logic to it. There might be a mountain range which divided a certain area. There might be a big river. There might be some such reason. But it's not logical. It's accidental that certain of these groups gathered together and came to be thought of as a country called France, and certain groups as a country called Italy, and so on. And so this national idea developed really after the end of our 600 years period. But it was beginning to develop during the 600 year period. Later on it becomes important until it's a very important factor by 1500. But now, number six, which I have referred to a number of times already, you cannot isolate any of these factors because they all were active together, though some at one period more than another. But number six is the preservation of culture in the monastery. There have been in history a number of times when a great civilization has been overrun as the Roman civilization was. And in a number of cases, it has been so completely destroyed that we just know nothing about it, or practically nothing. Maybe just a few little references on a marks on a stone tablet or something, or all that tell us about the existence of a civilization. Probably none of them as great or as widespread as the Roman Empire, but some of them pretty important. But the ancient civilization, memory of it was preserved, and not only preserved, but enough preserved to become a tremendously effective force in the establishment of the modern world. And while some of the ancient Romans, when they saw Rome sacked by the barbarians, and when they saw their civilization tottering, blamed it on Christianity, that Christianity had weakened the people and made them not ready to fight to preserve their civilization, yet the very fact that the memory of it was preserved and was one of the great factors in starting the new civilization of modern times is due to a certain expression of Christianity. So that's number six, the preservation of culture in the monastery. This is something which I know of no parallel to in any other of the civilizations that have perished. In Greece at about 1100 B.C., there was a great civilization which we find expressions of in Homer's Iliad, with a tremendous amount of wealth and with enough power in the various city-states that when they united together to fight against Troy or to attack Crete or for some other purpose, they could bring great forces and they could accomplish a very great amount. And they had tremendous wealth, too. And a great many of the people could read and write. And then the Dark Ages of Greece came at about 1000 B.C., and 200 years later, there was probably nobody in Greece who could read or write. And they had to get an entirely new system brought to them from Asia to start from scratch in learning to read and write. They forgot there had been such a thing as reading and writing. And up until 60 years ago, many people thought the whole story of the Iliad was a figment of the imagination because it presented a civilization in some ways much more advanced than the Grecian civilization in which the story was told, as having existed before that civilization began. And many people said it's just purely imaginary. And then we've excavated and found some of the great wealth and some of the signs of the tremendous centralization of power and the widespread use of writing that was in Greece at 1100 B.C. and that was just completely destroyed and forgotten, except for the little bit that was remembered and mixed up with a lot of myths and legends in the Iliad and the Odyssey. But when, in the providence of God, monasticism had developed between 300 and 400 A.D. And so that when the marauding tribes came through, there were groups of Christians living together in many places. And these groups of Christians living together, many of them had developed the habit their leaders had seen that if they just sat there and were left to their own resources, they would fall into sin and wickedness, and it was necessary to give them something to be actively doing. And they set many of them to copy manuscripts. And in the monasteries, which the barbarians, most of them spared because they were Arian Christians, but they were Christians, and they recognized these as Christians. In these monasteries, through the Middle Ages, ancient manuscripts were copied and recopied. And I suppose two-thirds of the great literature and science of the ancient Roman world was completely lost, but maybe one-third of it or less has been preserved because somebody was kept busy by being told to copy an old manuscript. And when the old manuscript disintegrated, we had the new copy, which then perhaps they tried to erase and wrote a copy of a religious document on top of it, but modern scholars with infrared photography are able to bring out the old document underneath the later writing, and some of our classics of ancient civilization have been preserved in this way. Now, I find it difficult myself to feel that this was a good development. From a cultural viewpoint, it was a very good development. But I find it difficult to keep from thinking that if those who developed the monastic system between 300 and 400 had, instead of that, been actively studying the Bible and trying to establish centers where people wouldn't go apart by themselves simply to develop their spiritual life, but where they would develop their spiritual life together for a while and then go out and try to reach the people around about and learn more ways of making Christian teaching really operate in the lives of the those who were Christians, and reaching more and more people for Christ. Whether instead of the monastic movement, there might not have been a spiritual movement sufficient to have really affected the barbarians when they came in and prevented the Dark Ages. I don't know whether that might have happened or not, but in the providence of God, it is not what did happen. But what did happen was that though I fear that a great deal of energy that should have gone into reaching others for Christ and teaching others really to live for Him went into simply people going apart by themselves into these monasteries. From the viewpoint of civilization, this did preserve reading and writing through the Middle Ages. And it did preserve a certain knowledge of the ancient world. And it preserved a certain group that had their thoughts not merely on how to get enough to live on and how to keep from being stepped on by the overlord, but how to develop the spiritual life. And there was a center from which eventually there could burst forth a new life. And Luther himself was a monk who, when he studied the scripture and found the truth, eventually turned strongly against monasticism. But a large part of his creed's development had been within the opportunities which the monastic life made possible for him under those circumstances. Well, now that's number six, preservation of culture in the monasteries. We're going to say a good deal more about the monasteries before we're through, of course. But we are now thinking under this head of the political and cultural situation, which is the background for the religious developments of these 600 years. And so I mentioned six simply from that viewpoint. And number seven is new migrations. New migrations. Scandinavian and Slavic. I guess I should have reversed the order of those, because the Slavic began first. Perhaps Slavic and Scandinavian is the better way to say it, because chronologically the Slavic begins first and continues longer, and the Scandinavian is in the middle of it. The Scandinavian went for about two centuries. While the Slavic is spread over a longer period, embraces far more people, but is much further east in an area we know less about than the Scandinavian migrations. Well, now the Slavic migrations, we don't know a great deal about. We know their results, but we don't know a great deal about them. But it's interesting that when you look at the languages of Europe, you start in the west with Portuguese, a development from Latin, then Spanish, a development from Latin, French, a development from Latin. In Switzerland, Ladinish, a development from Latin. Italy, which is definitely a development from Latin. But then you have to make a big jump over to Romania, which is another development from Latin. And in between, you have Bulgarian and Serbian and Croatian and these two or three other, Czechish, of course, and Slovak, several Slavic languages coming in between them. And these represent new migrations which occurred during this 600-year period. And these were people, the Germanic languages, were much more nearly related to Latin than these languages were. But these languages are related to each other, a group of languages of which the one spoken by the greatest number of people is Russian. And it's interesting that the Romans, of course, had taken Greek slaves in their early days. And then they took Germanic slaves. But then as time went on, their Germanic slaves were freed and became Roman citizens, and new Germans who came in became soldiers and then citizens. And so in the later days of the Roman Empire, the slaves were from a small number of these Slavic peoples who had begun to migrate. And so the Roman word slave, they applied to these people, though the Greeks had been, many Greeks had been slaves to the Romans. Other Italians had too, to some extent. And many Germanic peoples had been slaves to them, but all these people had largely become freed and become citizens. In the later period, those who were slaves were people speaking Slavic language. So the name slave came by the Romans to be applied to these people. And today, Slavic simply means the people who were slaves. Though if you take history as a whole, probably there have been less of the Slav slaves than of the Germanic people. But the word means the slave people. But today, it's merely a term which means a group of languages similar to Russian, which we call Slav. And this group of languages similar to Russian includes a dozen or so different languages. And there were different groups speaking these related languages. And they came in over a period of several centuries. Yes?
They were then slaves during the Dark
Ages? No. They had a few of them been slaves to the Romans toward the end of the Roman period. And then they came just to distinguish between somebody who spoke a Latin language or a Germanic language, somebody who didn't speak. If you knew a Germanic language, you could recognize the rest of them, even if you couldn't understand much of it. If you knew Latin, you could recognize the different dialects which developed into our modern languages. But this was quite different. And so you hear one of them, you say, oh, that's one of that slave group. And so they came to be the Slavic group, yes? The English used to boast that when a slave set foot on English soil, he was immediately free. But I think it wasn't more than 30 or 40 years that they said that before slavery was done away in many other countries. But slavery continued until within the last 100 or 150 years in most of the countries of the world. In England, as late as 1750 and perhaps later, a criminal, somebody caught in a fairly small crime, might be made a slave for a certain number of years. And many English people were shipped to America, say about 1700, as indentured servants, which was slaves. And they were held in slavery for often for a certain definite term of years. But slavery has been in almost all nations of the world up until within the last 150 years. And people taken in war were made slaves, as a rule. Or people were purchased from other nations, but all sorts of people might be made slaves. And when the Spaniards first came to America, they immediately seized a great many Indians and made them slaves and set them to work developing their plantations, but they soon found that the Indians died off quickly doing that work. They didn't have the stamina to stand under the force of the Spanish overseers, and they died off so quickly there wasn't much use making them slaves. So they looked elsewhere to find people of stronger stamina than the Indians to do this type of work. But there probably were not any more, maybe less, of the Slavic group that were slaves than of the Germanic group or the Greeks. But the name just happened to get developed that way. But the word Slavic has been used as now simply means a group of languages. A group of related languages, and so these groups came to the south during the 600 years. They migrated southward and they settled in what is now Bulgaria and now Yugoslavia. And in Yugoslavia there was a large group of them called Croatians who were reached by missionaries from Rome. And the Croatians today are mostly Roman Catholic. And then there was another group called Serbians, speaking a related but different language, who were reached by missionaries from Constantinople. And so the Serbians today, or at least until recently, I don't know recent developments, but in behind the Iron Curtain, but up to 20 years ago at least, the Serbians were members of the Greek Orthodox Church, the Croatians of the Roman Catholic Church, the Serbians that wrote an alphabet that looks like Greek letters. The Croatians wrote in Latin letters as we do. And their languages are closely related, though different, and together they form, with a couple of other groups, what we today call Yugoslavia. But the history of how these groups were reached with missionaries from the West or from the East, we don't know a great deal about. We know the names of a few of the missionaries. But all of these groups came to become at least nominally Christian during the period between 600 A.D. and 1300 A.D. But they are a group quite distinct in many ways from the Germanic peoples or from the Latin peoples. Well, now that's the Slavic migration. It was a great movement, including a great number of people, and some of them people of a great deal of ability. But they didn't really get a fair chance. I can't say they've had a fair chance yet in the world. They are in development, they're way behind most other nations. Not because the people are in any way inferior, but they simply haven't had the same opportunity that other people, many other nations have had. But they came in there, into this part of the old Roman Empire, and the Slavic area reaches from there clear north up through Russia, of course. And they're with their different languages and different customs, but yet a great similarity of language. Now the other migration, the Scandinavian, was somewhat different from this. The Scandinavian, there were groups of people who migrated, but as a whole, it was a series of marauding expeditions rather than migration. And it is strange today when you think of the generally peaceful character of the Danes and the Norwegians and the Swedes and the way they are usually thought of today as very peaceful people and very advanced people in civilization. It is strange to think of them as the wild, marauding attackers of the last part of our 600-year period. It began about 680. About that time, groups of people from Norway, perhaps, or Denmark, learned enough about navigation to do what they'd not been able to do before, to come down across the sea and attack other areas that were more developed than they were. And they began first attacking England. And there was a period when the Danes held half of England under their power. And there's a great deal of Danish blood in England today from individuals from this group who remained behind. And there's a great deal of Scandinavian blood in Scotland today. Most Scotchmen are rather short or small. When you see a great big one, you can generally attribute it to some of the Scandinavian blood that remains from that early period. And a large group of them came down to France and attacked a certain part of France. Of course, they were coming from the north. They were called the Northmen. And quite a group liked this section of France and settled there about 900. And a section of France to this day is called Normandy. And these wild, untutored savages, knowing only enough enough of navigation to make the trip down and enough of fighting to gain possession of this part of France, when they came in contact with civilization, developed it more rapidly than the Germanic peoples already in France, with the result that by 1000 AD, Normandy was the best governed part of France and perhaps the best organized. And they'd only been there maybe 100 years at that time. And a group of these Scandinavian marauders came as far as Sicily. Different boats used to come down, go through Gibraltar and attack some part of the Mediterranean, attack a city and seize plunder, seize people for slaves, take them back with them. But quite a group succeeded in gaining control of Sicily for a time. And a great deal of their blood remains in Sicily to this day. And so the results of the Scandinavian attack remain in all these countries to this day, but so mixed with the local population that you can rarely separate or distinguish them from them. So much for the new migrations. A great factor, one of which we know much more about the Scandinavian than the Slavic, though actually the Slavic was a far larger movement and left a greater number of people affected by it, but since they have not progressed as far as yet in civilization as have the areas in which the Scandinavians settled and from which they came, we don't know as much about that period, or it doesn't affect our immediate personal situation as much. That was number 7, wasn't it? Number 8 is political effects of the rise of Islam. Political effects of the rise of Islam. We will go into this a little more in detail later. First, for any who are not familiar with it, an explanation of the term. Islam is the proper term to use for a religious group. It is much more common, though, in the West to call it Mohammedanism. Its founder was Mohammed. But what he taught, he called submission. And Islam is the Arabic word for submission. Submission to the will of God, theoretically. And Islam, one might say, came... humanly speaking, it got its start because the people of the Eastern Roman Empire were too busy arguing about factors in the metaphysical constitution of Christ and trying to force others to take their view on certain details of something nobody can fully understand. They were too busy doing that to spend as much time as they should trying to reach the people around them for Christ. And the result was that though there was quite a Christian center in southern Arabia and in northern Arabia, and some Christian teaching in the center of Arabia, there was a man who came to the fore in central Arabia who knew a little bit about Christianity and was greatly affected by the little he knew, but who didn't know the heart of it. And I think the devil worked up a very clever device. He saw Christianity, and now that it had gotten control of the Roman Empire, reaching out into the Germanic tribes and the other untutored tribes and bringing them to the knowledge of Christianity rather rapidly, and saw that the pagan religions could not cope with the coming of Christianity, and he made a counterfeit which would be stronger to meet Christianity. And so Mohammed had a burning conviction as against the heathenism of Arabia that there was one God. And he preached that there is one God and we must submit to this one God. And some of our great Christian teachings are incorporated in Mohammed's teaching, but he denies that which is the power and center of Christianity, the atonement of Christ. He recognizes Christ as a great man, a great teacher, the greatest that ever lived, except, of course, for himself, for Muhammad. He was worthy of all honor, virgin-born, performed miracles, gave wonderful teachings, but the story of his crucifixion and his resurrection is just a myth, according to Muhammad. And so it is a counterfeit which has been more successful in resisting Christianity than any other religion on earth. And it is the hardest area of the world, aside from behind the Iron Curtain, of course, it is the hardest area in the world in which to do Christian missionary work, is the area where Mohammedanism holds sway. But it started at about 600. And humanly speaking, it might never have started and never made much progress if the desire which is latent in the hearts of all people, even if buried pretty deeply, to recognize the Creator, had been met properly by those Christians in that area who had the truth and could have gone out and spread it, but who instead spent their time arguing about points of theology which didn't affect their salvation, and in some of which nobody, no human being, can know the precise interpretation anyway. The Scripture gives us a certain light that we can stand on. But God sent us to this world not to understand all the mysteries of the universe, but to reach people for Christ and to do His work here. And so the greatest enemy Christianity has had, the most effective and most powerful, came into effect, humanly speaking, through the neglect of Christian people to do what God called them to do. So we look at that next Tuesday.